much larger. And I am being made an object lesson of what can happen if somebody dares to criticize. Yeah, a person in high office, somebody in high office in this administration. So I think, Amy, this is the reason why this has sparked so much domestic outrage as well as international outrage, because, you know, people, you know, really feel, you know, that this weaponization of the law, like the cyber libel, is something that has become the modus operandi of these heads of government and officials that really do not like criticism. So, you know, the people that you talk to, you know, throughout the whole range of the society here, throughout the opposition, they have come together on this on this case, because they know that if they win this case, if the administration you know, wins this case in the judiciary, and it's likely that it will win this case because it has a very strong control over judiciary, then people really feel that democratic rights are in very grave danger. That is what is at stake here at the moment, and I think people see it, which is why they've come together to demand that the administration, the Secretary of Justice at this point, just drop this charge against me.
Well, Walden Bello, of course, will continue to cover your case. Walden Bello, acclaimed Filipino scholar, activist, former vice presidential candidate in the Philippines, co-founded Focus on the Global South, arrested Monday and charged with cyber libel charges. He was released from police custody on Tuesday. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a people and culture manager. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke. Welcome back, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Sharina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astugio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Mary Conlin. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Stelly, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grand, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the Portland Folk Music Society concert series starting Saturday, September 17th with singer-songwriter Tim Grimm. The folk music series of 9 Saturday concerts starts September 17th and continues through May of 2023 at the Reedwood Friends Church on Southeast Steele. Season tickets are now available. Ticket information can be found at kboo.fm under Community Events.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth, exclusively on Pacifica Radio and its affiliate stations. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, we remember author, activist, and filmmaker Danny Schechter. He died on March 19th. He was 72 years old. Last year, Mr. Schechter stopped by the studios of KPFK to discuss his book, Madiba, A to Z, The Many Faces of Nelson Mandela. Today, we rebroadcast our discussion in honor of Danny Schechter, the news dissector. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. The price of gas around the nation is down to an average $4 per gallon for the first time in months. AAA says the national average is $3.99 for a gallon of regular. That's down 15 cents in just the last week and 68 cents in the last month. Gasoline peaked at around $5.02 a gallon in mid-June. California and Hawaii remain the most costly states to fuel up. Motorists are still paying above $5 there, and other states in the West are paying close to that. The cheapest gas is in Texas and several other states in the South and Midwest. The decline reflects falling prices for crude oil, which have dipped close to $90 a barrel from over $120 a barrel in June, and a fall off in demand as high prices deterred a lot of driving over the summer. France is dealing with the effects of record high temperatures and drought as firefighters from across Europe struggle today to get a handle on a massive wildfire that swept through a large part of pine forest in southern France. More from Future Story News' Ross Cullen in Paris.
The combination of the heat, the drought, it just makes for an awful situation for fires. And we've seen more sweeping wildfires in the Loire Valley and in around Bordeaux, thousands of hectares burnt overnight. That comes after the wildfires we had in July, when nearly 40,000 people had to be moved to safety.
That's Ross Cullen. Meanwhile, the British government has issued an excessive heat warning for England and Wales and has warned of the greater risk of fire that the high temperatures could bring. FSN's Laura Macon-Isherwood reports from London.
The latest heatwave to grip England and Wales might not smash records this time, but the prolonged high temperatures are still being considered a risk to health. The mercury is expected to reach 37 degrees Celsius between now and Sunday, leading the UK's Met Office to issue an extreme heat warning. As dry, hot conditions continue, water companies have started issuing usage restrictions. Some areas have been banned from using hose pipes to water gardens or wash cars. Other water boards are expected to follow suit. There are warnings too that the prolonged dry spell could create tinderbox conditions, with people warned to be on alert for potential fires.
And that's Laura Macon-Isherwood. A diplomatic spat has broken out between China and South Korea over a U.S. missile defense shield deployed in South Korea. The disagreement over the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, or THAAD, system installed in South Korea emerged after an apparently smooth first visit to China by South Korea's foreign minister this week. China contends that the THAAD's powerful radar, installed in 2016 as protection from North Korean missiles, could be used to spy on China. Korean officials say the country's national defense is not up for negotiation. President Yoon Suk-yeol has vowed to abandon the previous government's promises not to increase THAAD deployments and not to participate in a U.S.-led global missile shield or create a trilateral military alliance involving Japan. The House Rules Committee passed the Inflation Reduction Act Wednesday. This after the Senate passed the $740 billion climate, health care, and tax measure. Ana Lucia Ralda reports on Wednesday's debate.
The Inflation Reduction Act would invest $369 billion into renewable energy and other measures to reduce reliance on fossil fuels. It would also extend affordable health coverage to 13 million people, cap seniors' yearly out-of-pocket drug costs at $2,000 per year, and cap insulin costs at $35 per month for Medicare beneficiaries.
It will reduce their health care costs. It will ultimately reduce their energy costs.
But Texas Republican Michael Burgess slammed the legislation.
This Don't Say Inflation or Recession Act fails to reduce inflation, fails to reduce the budget deficit, and fails to reduce the world's temperature.
The House Rules Committee approved the legislation on a party-line vote, sending it to the full House for debate and final approval on Friday. I am Ana Lucia Ralda for Pacifica Radio.
And I'm Max Pringle. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
We now go to our conversation with journalist Danny Schechter, the world loss Danny Schechter, known as the News Dissector. On March 19th, we had the opportunity to sit down in studio with Danny Schechter when he was in Los Angeles on tour for his new book, Madiba A to Z, The Many Faces of Nelson Mandela. So our in-studio guest is Danny Schechter. Danny, thank you so very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Danny Schechter has a brand new book out, Madiba A to Z, The Many Faces of Nelson Mandela. And, of course, our listeners will recall at the time of Nelson Mandela's passing, I was part of a breaking news hour when we first got the news. And also we've been covering him on the show. And prior to that, of course, some of the latest in terms of what has been happening in South Africa. But I was curious, Danny Schechter, what got you interested in South Africa and in Nelson Mandela in the first place? How did it all start? It's been a long story.
But it goes back to being in the civil rights movement in the early 60s, back in high school, actually.
Where?
At the mighty DeWitt Clinton High School in the boogie down Bronx in New York City.
The Bronx.
Yeah, this was a school of 4,200 horny boys and a very well-known number of alumni, including James Baldwin, County Cullen, poets, writers, New York Times journalists. So, you know, it's an institution. It was the third high school in New York at one time. It was the largest high school in the world. I became the editor of the high school newspaper, the Clinton News, and as a high school editor, I went and met the kids who were in the original sit-ins in the South and got, you know, completely outraged by what they were telling me about what was happening there.
So you went south and met them?
No, I met them in Harlem.
In Harlem, okay.
Of A. Philip Randolph, the then head of the sleeping car porters, who was the actual person, who was the MC, who initiated the March on Washington first in 1942 and then in 1963.
Yeah.
And so we met there, and then I found out that one of the four students in Greensboro, North Carolina, had actually taken some classes at Clinton when he came to New York with his family at one point. And so, you know, I felt connected to this and became involved and was part of a group that started picketing Woolworth stores in Fordham Road in the Bronx, first in Harlem, but then at Fordham Road in the Bronx as the movement expanded and grew. And then I became a full-time, eventually civil rights worker with the Northern Student Movement and CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality. And what's interesting is that, of course, this year is the 50th anniversary of the deaths of Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney in Mississippi. And that's an event that's coming up. And I was at Cornell, knew Mickey Schwerner. And Mickey Schwerner, when he had been a dishwasher at a fraternity house. After his death, there was a vacancy. I became the Mickey Schwerner dishwasher in residence at the AE Pi fraternity. At any rate, so I had these connections with the civil rights movement. One of the things, I was also involved in SDS, and one of the things that happened,
which is Students for a Democratic Society.
Yeah, in 1964, was protest at the Chase Manhattan, was then Chase Manhattan Bank, to try to criticize the loans they were giving to the apartheid system. So I got involved that way, and then went to the London School of Economics, met all these South Africans who were in
England. You studied as a student at...
I did, okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I was part of the anti-war movement. I worked for a California magazine called Ramparts, based in London, investigating CIA involvement in Africa. So I became more deeply involved. And then in 1967, got recruited by the ANC, then in exile, to go into South Africa illegally as part of the armed struggle that was emerging there, to do a mission, along with a whole group of others in England who I never met because of compartmentalization. Nobody knew who else was in this. But there's a book out now called The London Recruits of whites who went to South Africa because they couldn't get their own people in because of the repression and the state of emergency that was happening. So I went to South Africa in the dark days of apartheid. Went to the funeral of Chief Luthuli, who was the president of the ANC before Mandela, was one of the great, he was a Nobel Prize laureate himself, and, you know, got exposed to this movement, you know, felt certain parallels with what I had seen in Mississippi and in the South in America, but also the terror of being in a police state, a totally repressive police state with all these laws outlawing dissent by and large, outlawing the ANC, the PAC, all the other movements for change. And this is now Mandela has already started his prison cell.
What year did you then
67.
First go?
67.
This was 67. So
Mandela had gone to Robben Island, I think, in 63.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this was the long, dark period for the, you know, for the struggle in South Africa, and there were people around the world.
So when you went to South Africa, did you stay there, or were you kind of going back and forth between
UK,
or can you say?
No, I wasn't. I was on this mission underground and went there and was there for, you know, 3 or 4 weeks, was terrified, didn't know if I was being brave or stupid in doing this because I wasn't really aware of the fact that you know, when you're 25 years old, you're invulnerable. You know, nothing's going to happen to you. Invincible. Nothing's going to happen. And, of course, one of the other recruits was put in prison for 10 years. So, you know, it was a scary thing to do. I don't think I fully appreciated it, but I'm proud of having done it. It also, in a way, I went to South Africa in 1967 and I never left because I became deeply involved in the anti-apartheid movement. I was not as a journalist and as a writer, but we formed the Africa Research Group in Massachusetts to analyze what the United States was doing in Africa and worked with the liberation movements in Mozambique, Angola, and the ANC in South Africa and others to try to provide information. Later, I became one of the organizers of the Sun City record, the album with Little Steven, Bruce Springsteen, 58 major stars, Miles Davis, and others against apartheid.
I wanted to ask you, though, because there's a lot of this story that isn't known, and I suspect that you know quite a bit of it. For example, when Nelson Mandela wanted to go to Cuba, this was at, you know, and meet Fidel Castro. The story that I have heard, of course, you know, there were protests, etc. But a story that I have heard is that when Fidel stuck his hand out to shake Mandela's hand, Mandela slapped it away, hugged him, and said, "None of this could happen without you." Now, you were involved in the whole Southern Africa movements,
right.
South
right.
Africa, but also surrounding. And we do know that the Cubans were also involved in there, including in a decisive battle that many people say had an impact then to what actually happened in South Africa leading up to the freeing of Nelson Mandela.
I actually cover this in my book, Madiba A to Z, mm-hmm. because, you know, a lot of people, many people in South Africa, even in the ANC, see the victory there as theirs alone, when in fact Mandela always saw it as the world's victory, the people from around the world acting in solidarity with the people in South Africa was the sort of secret sauce that helped push this movement into overdrive in many ways. And what the Cuban role was very crucial because the South Africans had, at the behest of Henry Kissinger, invaded Angola. And they were trying to overthrow the revolution in Angola and to stop the ANC, which was also had a base there. What happened there was the Cubans, in an act of what they called proletarian internationalism, sent troops twice to Cuba. And there was a battle in a town called Quito Carnivale, which is a key place in southern Angola where the South African army was defeated by the Cuban army working with the Angolans and the ANC. And this was a turning point because once that happened, there was negotiations first to extricate foreign forces from Angola, the Cubans and the South Africans, but then led to the independence of Namibia, which led to the beginnings of negotiations in South Africa. So it was a crucial period, which Americans know zero about because it wasn't really covered here in the United States, along with in all the obituaries of Mandela's death, there was not one reference.
That's why I wanted to talk about it. Not only that,
but the fact that the CIA helped turn Mandela over to the South Africans. And they bragged that he was, you know, their greatest triumph, you know, catching Mandela and giving them to the South Africans. And this, of course, even with the Snowden revelations, even with all this focus, was not reported like in the New York Times, which actually reported the story of the CIA involvement. You know, in other words, it's like this total, what I would call sort of selective amnesia mm-hmm. when it comes to filling in the historical context in any of this.
Yeah.
And this is some of the things I try to correct in my book, Madiba A to Z, which grew out of working on a documentary about the making and the meaning of the movie Mandela Long Walk to Freedom.
Right, and we'll talk about that in a minute. And our guest is Danny Schechter, has a brand new book, Madiba A to Z, The Many Faces of Nelson Mandela. So the reason I wanted to raise the story about Cuba is that it is very much left out. But in the Caribbean region, you know, Cuba is known for sending doctors, for sending teachers. Certainly those of us who knew anything about the Southern African movements appreciated, you know, the role that Cuba played there. And we find that here in the United States, there's very, very little, yeah. you know, about that. We know Che at some point, you know, went to Africa, the quote-unquote failed Africa mission, you know, et cetera. But it was notable, though, that President Obama was in a position of having to shake the hand of Raul Castro at the memorial for Nelson Mandela.
Well, if you go back a little bit, 1994, the inauguration of Nelson Mandela in Pretoria, South Africa, mm-hmm. Fidel surfaces, and he gets the biggest applause of any of the foreign leaders who were there. After Mandela's death, there was, of course, the funeral in South Africa, and Obama spoke, and he was given more time than any other leader, you know, because American TV, whatnot. And but, you know, he also, to his credit, mentioned that Mandela had led an armed struggle. Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, significant because he was on the terrorist list in the United States until 2008.
Right.
And he was elected in 1994. So the United States, you know, was still stigmatizing him. And just a month ago, 2 months ago in JFK in airport in New York, Tokio Soswale, who was one of the leaders of the armed struggle at one point, came to New York. He's now a billionaire. He's a businessman. Mm-hmm. And they wouldn't let him in because he's on the list. So the list is still alive here in the United States of paranoia and still discriminating against people that were, you know, determined to be terrorists, you know, all these years ago. So this is still still a reality. And so none of this, you know, they say the past is never past. And it's not passed here because there's still this history of American support for apartheid, American support of the South African government, which was in collusion with the Israeli government, building nuclear bombs. I mean, all of this history has been sort of buried.
Yeah.
And it's important to resurrect it. And that's, you know, a movie can't really do that. A movie follows a kind of narrative technique, Hollywood focus on the love story.
Yeah, but there's a lot that you have done and your book can do. I just want to remind our audience that you are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Margaret Prescott. Our in-studio guest is Danny Schechter. He has a brand new book, Madiba, referring, of course, to Nelson Mandela. Madiba A to Z, The Many Faces of Nelson Mandela. Danny Schechter, I was just this morning, I think, talking to someone about a continuum in history. And in thinking about the continent of Africa and thinking about Namibia, Angola, we've talked a little bit about that, about South Africa, it's important. And I wonder if you could say a little bit about that, because there's the history before then of the independence movements of leaders not, like Nkrumah, like Nyerere, and of course the assassination of Patrice Lumumba as a young man in what we're calling the Congo now. Looking at movements here in the United States, at least certainly in the black community, things are very nationalistic. That kind of international range and connection that Malcolm X had. So I'm raising this with you because I'd like you to comment on that, as well as you were trained somewhat in the civil rights movement. So you had a movement experience and then you went into South Africa and how you saw the international connection.
It was the death of Lumumba when I was at Cornell University. It led to a protest that we did there. And you know, which really got me into Africa. In 2009, I was in the Kinshasa, and actually got to tell the story of our protest to Lumumba's son. A story he had never heard before all those years later, how his death and the assassination of Lumumba really motivated me, because it was clearly done with the behest, with the involvement, complicity of the CIA as well. So, you know, and when you talk about Haiti, you know, of course, one of the issues that President Aristide raised was money owed by France to Haiti because of taxing the people of Haiti and all, you know, mm-hmm. for their own colonial subordination and demanding some sort of payment. This was an issue that was raised in South Africa as Mandela got out of prison. There was a debt, a giant debt that was run up by the masters of apartheid called the apartheid debt. And the international financial community, the World Bank, the you know, basically International Monetary Fund, told South Africa, you have to pay off this debt. They say, we have to pay off the debt. The debt was accumulated by buying bullets to try to kill our people. We're not, this wasn't a debt that we are responsible for. How can you hold us accountable for what the, you know, our oppressors did? And they said, well, if you're going to be in a legitimate government, you have to assume the responsibilities of the governments before you. And therefore, and they were forced to pay this debt. And this was one of the turning points in South Africa, because the struggle there was not just for political liberation, but for economic transformation. And the transformation of the economy sort of got undermined by this pressure coming out of these international financial institutions and the okay. United States.
I could only imagine, with the time that you spent with people who might have been working underground or in Southern Africa, there had to have been an impact and a continuum from those early leaders of the independence movements and then South Africa.
It was for good, right. for good and bad. You know, Nkrumah, who you mentioned,
uh-huh.
his famous advice was, seek ye first the political kingdom. In other words, take control of the state, end colonialism, and now you'll be a master in your own house. And what we've seen is, particularly in a country like South Africa,
took more than that.
Which was dominated mm-hmm. by a handful of big companies and mining companies and the like, just winning state power, political power, was not enough to actually deliver on economic promises to the people of South Africa.
What about leaders like Nyerere?
Well, Nyerere was, a supporter of the ANC. The ANC school in Morogoro in Tanzania
mm-hmm.
Educated people. He, you know, guerrilla forces were based there. I visited Dar es Salaam in Tanzania in 1967 when I left South Africa and met the ANC and all the other liberation movements in exile mm-hmm. on, of course, Nkrumah Street in Dar es Salaam. So there was a great feeling of Pan-African solidarity
right.
and
yeah.
a sense of Africa as a possible, you know, country at some point, you know.
As a possible whole,
African,
a unity.
African of, yeah. unity was a very decisive issue, and it's still an issue, but it's complicated because Africa has been under so much oppression by colonial powers and by multinational corporations, by international agencies, by U.S. and Britain and France and all the rest of it. So, you know, this has been one of the problems, but the spirit of African freedom is, of course, important. And this is what came through when I was at this UN General Assembly tribute to Mandela. Okay, just all this information. I didn't know anything about the Algerians talking about, you know, when he came to for military training from the Liberation Front in Algeria, which was then in exile in Morocco. And they met Mandela, and there are pictures, you know, of him with these Algerian revolutionaries. The Ethiopians were very much engaged. And that's when Mandela got out of prison. The first thing he did, and in my film, Mandela in America, the first thing I show is him going to these African countries
yeah.
and thanking the
people
of Namibia, thanking the people of Ethiopia and Dar es Salaam and Angola and Mozambique. You know, there was a sense of tremendous solidarity. But what we've seen, unfortunately, and not just in Africa, but in many, many places, the powers of corruption and greed and pressure from the outside has distorted a lot of the objectives. And there's a lot of frustration in all of these countries with the unfulfilled agendas and promises of liberation.
You know, on that story about the corruption and also an African unity, the widow of CLR James, Selma James, told me this story, that after when the war was winding up, World War II, Churchill and Roosevelt, FDR, had a conversation, and Churchill was puzzling. He was saying, well, we're going to have a problem after the war, you know, because all these countries, you know, they're going to be asking for stuff, just like the black soldiers came back to the U.S. Right. in the Civil Rights Movement. And FDR says, give them a flag and a national anthem. You know, that says so much. Give them a flag and a national anthem. Well, and, you know, that whole thing of busting up the whole African unity thing.
The power of co-optation. And
that's right.
Ambition, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, Africans, in, you know, I don't know if you know this, in South Africa, they sell more Mercedes than in Germany, okay? Mm. And you're a young African, okay? Mm-hmm. And you've gotten a job in a big American or Anglo-American corporation, South mm-hmm. African corporation, and you got to drive to work. Are you going to drive in a jalopy, or are you going to drive in a nice BMW so that you can show your success as well? And, of course, what's happening now is a whole wave of repossessions of people who are in hock because they ended up, you know, wanting all these symbols of affluence, and they couldn't really afford them. They borrowed money, and now, and this is a pattern that we've seen all over the world, including in our country. In a way, the world has become more similar, and a lot of what we would consider bad values are dominant. I mean, you're a broadcaster. The South African Broadcasting Corporation had the promise of really being a voice of the liberation struggle in all of Africa. And there's just been one scandal after another. The most recent one involves the head of the SABC and money that are missing and all the rest of it. I mean, it's a hideous lack of responsibility, and also in terms of programming about the past. That's why this movie, Mandela Long Walk to Freedom, made by a South African company, is important, because they're trying to tell the history, but they have to make certain concessions for Hollywood distribution and the like.
Right, and I know you have a view on that film, but I want to just go back, just bear with me just a little bit, to go back a little bit more before, you know, jumping to where we are now. I want to know, what impact did your experience and training in the civil rights and or black movements here in the United States, what impact did that have on you in terms of your work then in relation to South Africa?
Well, it had a lot. First of all, I was shown at an early age that people can organize, can work together, can mm-hmm. operate in a democratic way within a movement, and mm-hmm. and SNCC and you know, the movements,
Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee,
the movements mm-hmm. in the South, and you know, I worked in Harlem, you know, I got to know Malcolm X, I got to meet Martin Luther King. I mean, you know, this was a very heady experience for a boy from the Bronx, you know,
white guy from the Bronx.
On the other hand, what I found was a great receptivity, and you know, you would be judged on the basis of your contribution. And, you know, I feel I learned a lot, but there was also something else going on in that period, which was, of course, the war in Vietnam. And that led me and so many others in my generation to develop a critique of, well, you know, what we called imperialism, what we saw as an internationalization of racism and domination and all the rest of it. So in London, particularly, there were massive rallies against the war in Vietnam. I was part of the what was called the Stop It Committee, Americans in Britain mm-hmm. against the war in Vietnam. So all of these influences affected me. And, of course, we saw in that period, this is when Che Guevara was talking about 1, 2, 3 many Vietnams, that the United States imperialism could be stopped by kind of armed struggles in different countries, and, of course, led by Vietnam.
Right.
And so, and the Vietnamese not only did finally, you know, end the Saigon government and American policy in Vietnam, but later, and I reveal this in my book, the Vietnamese helped the ANC in South Africa reorganize their armed struggle as well. And the ANC sought them out because they were a successful example of all of this. So, you know, this was
successful guerrilla fighters.
Yeah, and this was the turbulence. So when I got involved coming out of South Africa with this Africa Research Group, what we were looking at was American intervention in Africa, and what forms it took, a military intervention, as well as political intervention. And mm-hmm. We found documents, as before Edward Snowden, because we didn't have the internet in those days, but we found documents from the Defense Department and other places, American intelligence agencies, of what they were planning to do in Africa. And I wrote about this in Ramparts Magazine. So, these are the issues that we're still coping with today.
Absolutely.
And they go back. They have this history that's quite fascinating. Most people don't know, in part because they're never taught or it's not in our media and all the rest of it.
So we're just going to pause for our station break. And when we return, we're going to be continuing our discussion with Danny Schechter, author of a brand new book, Madiba A to Z, The Many Faces of Nelson Mandela, also of numerous films, etc., on South Africa and on Nelson Mandela. You're listening to a one-hour Sojourner Truth special with author, activist, and filmmaker Danny Schechter, recorded before his death. He died in March 2015.
This is Ed Asner. You're listening to Fearless Drive Time Radio, Sojourner Truth, with host Margaret Prescott.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to return to our very informal and wide-ranging discussion with Danny Schechter. We're doing great, Danny.
Okay. Good.
Danny Schechter, the news dissector. Wow, I'm glad to have the experience of the news dissector here. But you mentioned in the earlier part of our interview, you were talking a bit about some background and history on this whole issue of corruption. Before Nelson Mandela was released from Robben Island, there was a rather lengthy period of time in which he was, quote unquote, being debriefed. But there's also, the controversy about the kinds of economic deals that perhaps he made even before he got out that could have, if that story is indeed true, a big impact on what is not happening in South Africa today, where we see former ANC members wealthy, driving around in expensive cars, living in fancy neighborhoods, while the people who are impoverished in South Africa pretty much remain impoverished.
Well, first of all, let me just point out, because we do have a way of forgetting these things, that South Africa, under the Afrikaner all-white mm-hmm. government, was notoriously corrupt. Mm-hmm. They were even into nationalization, creating entities controlled by the government so they could create jobs for their own people.
Okay.
So this was a government riddled with corruption. And one of the things that happened is when the discussions began about what would be the new economy, what would happen in South Africa, Mandela and the negotiators were taken aside and they were told, we need housing, we need schools, we need reconstruction, we need jobs, we need all of these things that we're not getting. And, one of the other guys said, well, I hate to tell you this, but we've just checked the treasury and there's no money. They've stolen all the money, okay? And in fact, before the transition happened, the old government gave what they called lifeboats, which are large billion-dollar rand loans to the four major banks in South Africa to tide them over in what they expected would be a very disruptive but short transition. Mm-hmm. Most of them thought, you know, Mandela will be a 6-month wonder. You know, he can't possibly have the experience to run a complicated country like this. And, you know, we'll be back sooner rather than later. But in the meantime, let's keep our banking structures in place. So a lot of the money was gone. And so now you have a situation where you're making plans about what you want, what you need. What the people want, you know, and the election of 94, the slogan of the ANC was a better life for all.
Uh-huh. Okay?
How do you deliver on a better life for all when you have no money? And so they had this little problem, okay? Before the new government was elected, the country was being run by something called the TEC, the Transitional Executive Council.
Mm-hmm.
Don't Google it because you won't find anything there about it. It's like missing from history. But there was an economic council that was part of it, this I go into it in my book, and it was made up equally of 8 members of the old government and 8 members of the ANC government in waiting, so to speak. And they needed money to have, you know, the balance of payments problems and issues and what have you. And the IMF, the World Bank, said, yeah, we'll give you a loan.
Mm-hmm.
No problem. You know, what do you need? You know, we'll be happy to, you know, help you here. But we have a few conditions.
Yeah, of course.
Okay. And among our conditions are, first of all, that all 16 members of this TEC committee sign off on this unanimously. So in other words, here, the oppressor who's on the way out is given equal power to the liberator who's on the way in. Okay? And the next part of it is the deal that was made is you will accept the Washington consensus, which means we support the market economy. So the ANC, which wanted to nationalize banks, was basically told, no, no, no. That would send the wrong signal. You won't get investment if you seem to be nationalizers. And this message was also reinforced to them by what was left of the communist world. In other words, the Soviet Union was their biggest supporter, East Germany, etc.
And that was
disintegrating.
Yeah.
So now comes Vietnam and China, and they're all saying, listen, our advice is do not make this part of your political plank because it will turn people off. You enjoy so much popularity in the world. This is controversial. It will divide people about these policies. You don't have the capacity really to run these institutions. Don't do it. We tried to do it. That's why we're moving towards more of a market, you know, market Leninism in China and what have you.
Oh, please.
So this is the pressures they were under. And at the same time, when Mandela got out of prison, he was dealing with 35,000 white right-wing people with arms. And I talked to Joe Slovo,
yeah,
who was the head, you know, negotiator, really, the head of the Communist Party. I said, this was when he first came back from Lusaka to, mm-hmm, Johannesburg. We're sitting in his backyard.
Yeah.
And I said, Joe, what's on your mind right now? What are you worried about? He says, two worries that probably nobody in my country has. I said, what are they? First, Nicaragua. The Sandinista movement, which won the revolution, has just lost an election.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember this.
Oh, yeah.
If they lost an election, we can lose an election. It's not, none of this is guaranteed, okay? And we have to play our cards very carefully.
Yeah.
We don't have, and then secondly, Chile. What happened to Allende in the aftermath of Allende? That was in his mind. He said, we don't have the arms and the expertise to really defend ourselves. The only defense we have is it for to get the world community on our side to support our struggle. This struggle is going to be very short-lived. How do we make South Africa, our changes, unchangeable? And this was the dilemma that they were dealing with. They realized it was a dilemma because they had to compromise. None of us like to compromise. You know, we want to hold our ideals very dear to us, close to us, and all the rest of it. And they were facing some real-world choices that were, you know, sometimes they were all bad choices, bad options. How do you deal with this? How do you bring, you know, thousands of soldiers back from who believe they've won the revolution, okay, back to South Africa? You don't have houses for them. You don't have jobs for them. You know, in other words, this was a very complicated setup. And so it lends itself to people who don't really know the details of any of this stuff, you know, simply saying, well, Mandela sold out. It was assumed that Mandela was calling all the shots, which, of course, he wasn't, because it was a collective leadership. Oliver Tambo and all of the other great ANC leaders. So, you know, this is how simplification and rhetoric and often undermines our understanding of what was going on and what they had to do and what their choices were. Plus, they're hit by, there was a devastating epidemic of AIDS that the old government ignored.
Our guest in studio, he has a brand new book, fascinating from all accounts, Madiba A to Z, or A to Z, as they say in some parts of the world, The Many Faces of Nelson Mandela. On that note, and looking at the clock, I want to raise the issue of Winnie Mandela.
Okay, sure.
There are a lot of stories, there are a lot of feelings, there are a lot of tensions, still today even, you know, on this question of what happened with Winnie Mandela and the political fight, the political disagreement between, we're told, Winnie Mandela and Nelson Mandela.
Well, you know, Winnie Mandela became the spokesperson of the ANC in the years that the ANC was underground. She was the one explicit figure leading, you know, speaking out eloquently on behalf of the ANC. And she was paid the price. In the movie Mandela Long Walk to Freedom, you see her being imprisoned, beaten, and all the rest.
Tortured.
This was not a situation that, and also isolated in many ways, because new political structures, the United Democratic Front, and various local movements, labor movements began to emerge. And, you know, Winnie felt that she was, in a sense, the mother of the nation, the leader of the movement, and wasn't getting the respect due to this. On the other hand, she was often, you know, dealing with issues that were a lot more immediate for people than people who are sitting in Lusaka writing theoretical papers. She was, you know, when somebody's house burned down or son was killed or police brutality, these people would come to Winnie Mandela to seek her support and help. So she was under a tremendous amount of pressure. And when you're under tremendous pressure like that, you know, and you're isolated in a way and you're trying to be a mother of two, you know, children, plus you have this movement that was often male-dominated, you know, you can see the seeds of a lot of, you know, discord, let's put it that way, and anger and frustration. She was a younger woman. She married Nelson. He was much older than her. He comes out of prison as this kind of, statesman figure, icon, and whatnot. And she's expected to play second fiddle now. She's, you know, the first lady or the wife. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she believed that the time, that we have to continue the struggle right now. He believed, no, we have to negotiate. That's our only hope of actually consolidating power. It's not just, you know, getting power, but consolidating it, getting it so that it's permanent in a way. And, you know, she was not, he was a lawyer. She was a social worker and an activist. And there was, you know, cultural divide. And a rabble rouser. And I think in the movie Long Walk to Freedom, you see that relationship begin to fray. Mm-hmm. And this was very painful for Mandela because it was her presence that kept his morale up in prison for all these years.
He loved her for so long.
And, you know, he had a picture of a naked woman on his desk in his cell, you know, a little desk there, you know. And called Neolitha. And they said, well, who is she? And he says, I keep her here so that Winnie will be jealous. He had a great sense of humor about all of this. And you know, they had this picture book relationship. But when you have a picture book relationship, there are often things going on the inside that you don't want to know and don't want to see, like real human problems, you know. And, you know, in the end, the family's reconciled. Gracia Michelle, the you know, ex-wife.
The widow now.
The widow of Samora Michelle first, and now of the leader of Mozambique, and then of Nelson Mandela. They reconciled with each other. You know, Winnie's personality was far more outspoken, and you know, I have a lot of respect for her. I spent some time with her. You know, she's a force of nature in some ways. But this clearly, when she moved back to Soweto, broke her banning order. She was in this place called Bronfort. Mm-hmm. And she moves back, and there's a structure in place in Soweto called a Committee of Ten. These were ten leaders that had been chosen by the people. Mm-hmm. And she comes back, and now she wants to be the leader. And they say, well, no, we don't. We're not operating. We're operating. They were far more democratic in the United Democratic Front than in the ANC. The ANC was a structure of top-down leadership. Mm-hmm. This was a structure of bottom-up democracy. And, you know, and so there was a conflict. And then Winnie started taking actions of various kinds, which led to her being threatened, which led to her getting this so-called Mandela football team of young men who were thoroughly infiltrated by the police.
Police, no doubt.
The killing of Sampi, mm-hmm. who is a young man who was like the boy general of the movement there,
yeah.
which happened in her home. Nobody blamed her directly for it, but there was all these questions and the trial. And Mandela stood by her.
He went to the trials.
Mm-hmm. And people in the ANC told me, you know, he drove us all crazy. You must come to the trial to support Winnie. Mm-hmm. And they were saying, well, Winnie has done some things we can't support. I mean, you know, Winnie is out there. You know, she's arrogant. She's not listening. And I think she also had in this period, I don't know how to put this delicately, you know, let's put it this way. In America, high-profile political wife or personality has a problem. There's the Betty Ford Clinic. There's some place to turn for supportive help and therapy. Mm-hmm. When you're a high-profile leader in a township in South Africa in a polarized political environment, there's no help.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, Winnie had some problems. I'm not a psychiatrist, and I'm not claiming to be, that led to her discord, and the two of them, you know.
Well, she was treated so badly in prison. I mean, she was tortured. She was taken from her children. I mean,
horrible.
That's got to be some kind of post-traumatic.
Oh, it is, and it affected her, clearly. And this is where this conflict took place. I mean, they were supposed to leave the prison like at noon or something like that. And Winnie is not there. Where is she? He doesn't want to leave without her, you know, and they put their fists up in the air. And it turns out that one of the people who was in the ANC and the United Democratic Front, they were supposed to charter a plane together. She wouldn't fly with him in the plane because she was pissed off that he didn't support her. Mm-hmm. Okay? So instead of going by jet, they went by prop plane, which meant the whole thing was delayed. So there's a backstory mm-hmm. to what happened, which I tell in my book about in a chapter called Waiting, about waiting for Mandela, you know, and what happened on the day of his release, a fascinating, even funny story about how he gets lost from all the people protecting him. Nobody knows where he is. I mean, it was a crazy, you know, situation, very human situation. So I dug what I was looking for in doing this book, stories we haven't heard before, issues that are fascinating and that tell us more about him, but also about this movement and the conflicts within this movement. And I was told by this man, Mac Maharaj, who helped smuggle Long Walk to Freedom off of Robben Island, had been a prisoner. And he says, you know, Mandela is like, if he's met you before, he remembers you, he'll come up and shake your hand. He did it to me. Came up to me in New York, you know, walked across the room, all the security comes right up to me. And he says, remember me? You know, I think so, you know. He had this great sense of presence. And in a way, he was playing a role of Mandela, you know, the leader. He was much more complex than that one role. But, you know, he was like that. But, you know, when Mac Maharaj told me, you can get, he will be friendly, he will be open, he'll ask you about your children, he may remember the names of your children, you're amazed to be in his presence. But then when you try to get into his private life and his personal thoughts, a shutter comes down. And he had to protect himself in prison to be able to survive. You know, he was in my book, I talk about him as a boxer, you know, having mm-hmm. the discipline, a physical discipline of a boxer, of you know, diet and exercise and everything else. And she enabled him to survive to age 95. Pretty amazing, given the fact that he contracted TB in prison. And that's what, in the end, the respiratory diseases and stuff come out of that. So they killed him, actually. Yeah. But, you know, he's also old, so you can't blame them. I don't know if you can or you can't. But the point is,
yeah,
the point is that there's this other side to all of this. And that's what's the interesting part of it. How does somebody coming off of a rural area, you know, in Eastern Cape, South Africa, you know, somewhere, become the biggest brand in the world next to Coca-Cola, known by everyone in the world, and respected and loved and admired by everyone except the Academy Awards.
Which takes us now to the film that coincided, actually, with at least the release in some places with the passing, the death of Nelson Mandela. So you have some thoughts about the film.
I do. I think it's a good, great film.
Mm-hmm.
I think it tells the story. It leaves a lot out. And was the producer of the film, Anand Singh, a South African, who encouraged me to write this book to tell the rest of the story.
Okay.
He was very clear that this was not and couldn't be the full story because it's mm-hmm. a dramatic movie.
Yeah.
Okay. But, you know, this film, when it came out, was reviewed by the LA Times, by the New York Times, by all the top outlets, was praised as an Oscar contender. Idris Elba's performance, Naomi Harris's performance as Winnie are brilliant, okay? And it got no nominations except one for the song written by Bono and U2, which is at the end
that
of the movie.
It?
And why did it get that? Because the Academy Awards themselves wanted Bono to perform at the awards ceremony in order to build up the TV ratings of the Academy Award. I respect him, but the point is to give the booby prize to this song, which is a love song, it's not a political song, and to ignore the movie, I think is a real problem.
Has Bono said anything about
no,
that?
No. I mean, nobody who's involved with the movie would say anything because they don't want to, it seems like sour grapes. But I'll say it. I feel like you look at 12 Years a Slave, okay? Good movie, no question. But what is its message? What is it about? It's about subjugation and victimization. It's about a slave from the North who gets kidnapped and brought to the South. Not about the millions of Africans who were enslaved and brought to America against their will and mistreated the way they were.
Well, I happen to differ on that.
Okay,
I mean,
that's good.
I think the film was an excellent film. It has opened the door for a conversation, but not only a conversation, but a kind of a humanization of slavery. I mean, people think of slavery as like this institution and not face the humanization of it. So I'll say that in defense of 12 Years a Slave. But I also saw Mandela, cried my eyeballs out, and I thought they did a terrific job. So I think it is a snub.
You know, it's a snub, and also the word on the street is they can only nominate one black film.
Oh, please.
Okay. So there was a...
what does that tell you?
That tells you something. And also the fact that this was made by a South African, not somebody connected to the studio system here in Hollywood, I think was a factor in it as well. And there's been absolutely no discussion or debate about this in any of the entertainment media. I've written an open letter to the Academy Awards about raising some of these questions. It's got exactly zero pickup. And, you know, I think there is a discussion here. I felt 12 Years a Slave was an important movie, but unfortunately, you know, I don't think, you know, the themes of slave rebellion, you know, in a way, Django was more of a rebellion, you know, kind of a shootout.
Fantasy.
Fantasy, mm-hmm. What have you. So I'm not against that movie. I'm not really, but I do think the idea of liberation, the idea of struggling, of people struggling for freedom as a theme is very important and was snubbed by the Academy Award. And a lot of it was, well, he died, there was all this TV coverage, so we're Mandela'd out. You know, we know the whole story, et cetera, and so forth, which, of course, is not true. So that was my cultural critic hat for the moment, okay?
All right.
And I'm prepared to get hissed and booed by a lot of people around it, but I really feel like, Mandela's importance is not just for South Africa. It's for the world that people can fight back and win, however imperfectly, okay? And that lesson is something that our children need to hear as well. We need to learn about. And I'm afraid that, like so many other things, it'll be relegated to, you know, what happened to Dr. King, which is what do people remember? Four words, I have a dream. You know, mm-hmm. they don't know anything about Dr. King and about the struggle.
And how, about how radical
that
he was part of. Yeah.
Exactly. So this is the way our culture reduces, you know, issues and ideas, and that's what I'm saying.
And reduces our movements, because all of these great leaders were leaders because of individual people who had next to nothing, who were the ones who made the movement. Same thing with the civil rights movement. So, Danny Schechter, that means that people are indeed going to have to read your book.
I hope
so. To find out what really happened.
Yes, yeah, Madiba A to Z, The Many Faces of Nelson Mandela, Seven Stories Press, MadibaBook.com is the website. I can be reached at dissector@mediachannel.org if anybody wants to be in touch. I edit mediachannel.org and blog at newsdissector.net.
Well, Danny Schechter, you're full of information, and we're going to have you back. Thank you for joining us.
I hope so. Thank you.
We're out of time. I'd like to thank our guest, Danny Schechter, and I'd like to thank the entire Sojourner Truth team. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott, and our team, our engineered assistant producer, thank you. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Please check out our website at www.soultrueradio.org and like and friend us on Facebook. If you are a member, look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. ¶¶